American justice system currently appears to be systemically broken. We do a lot of David and Goliath type cases.
We're a nation of laws, or at least we're supposed to be. We're going to have to test the proofs that underlie this order, which haven't been done.
I'm trying to fight for justice.
I've spent 30 years in the police department. I've seen a lot. You know, what's being said to you today and what you're reading, if it wasn't true 10 years ago, then you have to question that.
How in the hell did we get here and where the hell are we going?
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Two Average Joes. This one's going to be special.
We have a special engagement between Collective Development and a Red, White, and Blue project, including us, the Two Average Joes.
Right, and we've got a lot of things to talk about. We've got a movie, The Making of An Ordinary Killer, and it's big stuff. And it's going to be special, and I think there's some things where you may not understand it now, but there's some parallels between what they did in the movie and what we're doing right now.
Yeah, and this is a behind-the-scenes titled Beyond Ordinary, and rightfully so. It shows how this movie was made and what and whom it's all about.
Yeah, this is going to be good. There's going to be clips in here, clips before, clips after, but pay close attention because we're going to probably be talking about one of the individuals from this movie, Jerry Weingard, on several episodes as time progresses.
Yeah, we're going to see several segments like the trailer, the composer's discussions in the news, and the moment of the sentencing of the serial killer. And I'd like to talk just a little bit about how we got here, because when we started, we originally started doing political news, which went over like a lead balloon. And then we shifted.
Yes,
we ended up in YouTube jail. So then we went to doing true crime about 18 months ago, was it?
Yeah, 18, 19 months ago.
Right. And then I think we did 26 episodes on what's known as the co-ed killings or the Michigan murders, depending on who you talk to. And it was a series of killings that occurred from 1967 to 69. And the gentleman that this movie is about and the behind the scenes is about the making of, Mr. Weingart, was in Ann Arbor at the time. I believe he was working at the computer lab for University of Michigan, correct?
Correct. And we got some Dean, and he'll talk a little bit more about it later. We actually got a FOIA that said that he was actually a suspect. Now, why that didn't materialize in the more, I don't know, but it didn't.
Yeah, and it goes on, and we've said it many times, but they try to put all of this on John Norman Collins in the books, the media, everything, and it doesn't seem like it's true. For one, they say the killing stopped, and they absolutely did not stop in Michigan, and in some cases, they ramped up. But anyway... Yeah. That's our background. You're going to see all of the group together. We'll talk about it, and then we'll have the showing of the actual behind-the-scenes story. So,
you got it. And so everybody, action, and here we go. Y'all have a good one and enjoy.
Please do.
This is actually a special one. We're going to talk about the making of a movie, the making of An Ordinary Killer, did I get it right?
You got it.
There it is. Everybody wants the plural stuff, so I had to be careful there. This movie was made many years ago, but it's very, very apropos to right now because of the topic, which Dean's going to talk about, and how it's going to tie into Two Average Joes in the future. So, Dean, without further ado, give us a little bit of background on An Ordinary Killer.
Okay, produced by Collective Development Incorporated out of Lansing, Michigan. I hold the title of the chief operating officer for that company. And when we make a movie, each movie is made under its own LLC. That being said, each movie has a different set of producers, directors, cast, crew, you name it. In this particular case, it was a screenplay brought to life by Tony Hornus and DJ Perry. Now, what's interesting about Tony is if you go all the way back to high school, Tony went to high school with Don Magyar. So he's very close to that murder. He was also a reporter at the Argus Press for many, many years and covered that particular murder as well as other things. But fast forward till about 1998 when two detectives, Steve Harshberger, I think is how you pronounce it, and Mark Pendergraft were still working as Michigan State police officers on the case of Don Magyar. And they got a break in the case. And, of course, Tony was privy to that. And he had already been writing a book. I think he had been on it about 7 years. So when this break in the case came through, he put it into high gear, got a hold of DJ Perry, said, hey, we got to make this movie. It's happening right now. I think it took him a year to do the screenplay. And we got an investor by the name of Leonard Krawcheck, I believe was his name. He was the owner of Hillcrest Memorial Gardens in Owosso, Michigan. And oddly enough, that's where Pamela Hill is buried, who was murdered from that area as well. We'll talk about her later. But that being said, the movie started. That was 2001. That's back before we really got into high definition and things like that. So we were filming on DAT tapes. We don't use DAT tapes anymore. It's all digital now. The movie got completed and it had great reception. It was a fantastic film. But the thing about movie making is you got to have a good distributor, a distributor that's going to really get it out there. And Ordinary Killer really didn't have that. Consequently, it really didn't get its saturation in the market, nor did it get international play. Now, when I came into Two Average Joes, started working with you guys, we started talking about a guy by the name of Gerald Leroy Weingart and started researching that. And that brought us to where we are today. This movie is about Gerald Leroy Weingart, and it starts by showing his first offense, which was the rape of a blind girl and robbing her boyfriend. And then we move through the movie into the actual murder of Don Magyar. And we do a lot of interplay into the investigators, the detectives, and how they brought it all together. The story's true. Everything in it is true, is written very accurate by Tony. So that's kind of what we have. And then we did a wonderful behind the scenes. And this is the interesting part that I just can't believe. When the trial was going on in Howell, we were filming the movie in Owosso. And Tony set up an opportunity for us to actually go to the sentencing. Camera crew, everybody there. And we actually got to film that. And that's in the behind the scenes. Now, we're bringing the behind the scenes to life here in this podcast.
We really do get to look at Weingart's attorney, prosecuting attorney, get to see him. We'll go into more detail as this progresses, but Jerry Weingart turns into a very interesting person. So it's not just the movie. Several things are coming out of this movie. Number one is, we're going to offer you the behind the scenes. I think that this is where we want to go at a high quality of being able to do high quality podcasts, high quality programming, and then, you know, making it available for sales, because without getting too lost on this, distribution is everything. Deneen, when we go back and talk about a lot of the things that we had done, and we were looking for, even on other programs, you know, explain just how much it's just really a process that is way more time consuming than people may understand.
I think doing research and making sure your research is accurate, it really because like we've talked in the past about myths and stuff you find on there, it's really in like with Dean's work he's done with this movie, everything is accurate, and it takes a lot of time to get that.
One thing, Robert, I think is I'm going to turn it over to you in a second, but go into the fact of how difficult it has been to reach this level.
Well, we started out, we really haven't advanced that far other than Dean has brought us into the 21st century, I guess, but we just had like, and I'm still operating on it, a Mac computer with all the fixings. I believe, Joe, you went out and bought some fancy rigs and stuff for microphones and things.
Well, yeah, I did, but I got to get another computer because this one stinks. I bought that stuff, and then if I plugged it all in, I would be out in the abyss.
But Joe is retired, and I'm a practicing attorney, so I haven't had the time to, and I've had the hopes and dreams of buying a nice, I've looked into it and studied it, of getting a nice rig. But since Dean has come on the scenes, our production value has hopefully this one, other than me leaving and going, but is higher quality, and the DPI, I think, is going to be a whole lot higher. And hopefully our entertainment value will go up.
There you go. Well, let me say this. Actually, the beginning and the end of this being grafted on and then having a thumbnail is a lot more work than people would think.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right, there it is. Dean, anything else you want to put on there before I get into Jerry Weingart?
Other than the fact that I think people need to realize this movie has been out of circulation for quite some time. So to bring a movie like this back into, viewing, we had to do the first thing DJ wanted done was to increase the resolution of the picture from a standard definition to a 4K, which I just completed that this week. In fact, I sent you guys links on that. That was a big process. And, there's a lot of things, Joseph, like you're saying, there's a lot of things that have to be done to get it to that point. Mm-hmm. We will get it there, and you will have an opportunity to see this film. So I guess I just want everybody to realize we're putting a lot behind it. Yes. To get it up to the current day. So
yes. And let me do this right now for everybody if you haven't heard of Jerry Weingart. Jerry's goes back to 1961 where he did commit a rape and of a blind girl and basically rob her boyfriend. Now, there are some very interesting things about Jerry that got lost in the shuffle. Anybody knows that we have talked about John Norman Collins. We have discussed him in detail. What many of you may not know is that Dean, through his research, actually does have evidence that Jerry Weingart was a suspect in those so-called co-ed killings. And a lot of people don't know that, but other than one of those, Jerry's out of prison. Right, Dean, I think there's the very first one that would be said was a Kerry killing. He wasn't.
Yeah, Mary Flazer. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. And if I didn't pronounce it right, I'm sorry. But she passed away in the summer of 67. Mm-hmm. And Weingart walked out on parole December 1967. So he was available to the public from that point forward.
Yeah. And, just from what we have, and we're going to do some more program on Jerry, so I don't want you to think that we're not. We are. But he lived around a lot of these murders. He lived in and of the area that this was. And he was the type of guy, he was basically a predator.
Yes. And
so that needs to be kept in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we'll have some overlays to show you of just how close Jerry was in proximity of all of that. So what really becomes interesting is for all those people that want to blow off John Norman Collins and say, oh, well, when he got arrested, all the killing stopped.
So who got to see the film so far? Deneen, did you see it yet?
Yes, I have.
And
I really enjoyed it. I watched it last night, and it's really a good movie, and it's fact-based, and that's what you need in a movie like this.
Okay. And Robert?
Yeah, I watched it today. I had a client until about 5 o'clock, so I watched it on 1.5 speed. But what I have to say is the high definition, the quality, and I don't know how you did it, uncompressing or compressing, whatever it did to reformat it, but man, it really comes out. It stands up. It looks like it was shot yesterday. And the acting, and I think Grizzly Adams, the actor who played Grizzly Adams, is in it. I mean, everybody really did a stellar job acting that I could see. And I didn't see any holes in the plot or the acting. And I thought for it to be 23 years old or however old it is, it really stands up, I believe.
Yeah.
Good deal.
Well, I'm excited about it. And I know everybody else is too. Like I said, we're getting ready. We'll give you information how to obtain it. And we're going to work on this, and it's going to be part of our project.
I'd say you got plenty to be worried about, my friend. I mean, the humanity of the victim, we can't let it get obscured by the mayhem of the moment.
I've never seen anything like this. I'm a cop from a small town. Miss D reminds me of her. Ever wonder, though, if evil is something inherent?
Who has fantasies or delusions? Find a motive. He knew exactly what he was doing.
I'm worried about her with all these killings.
You got plenty to be worried about.
Miss D reminds me of her.
Dave, don't come in here!
I will. Ah!
Until March of 2001, I had been working 7 years on a nonfiction book concerning this case. I went to school with the murder victim, very sweet young lady, well-liked, traveled in a lot of our social circles. She was a friend. In small-town America, she was our friend. And of course, we didn't have an answer to who or why, and science and technology in 1994 was advanced enough that we could take the evidence from 1973 and apply it, and we got a genetic profile of the killer. And through the hard work of these detectives, we had an arrest made in March of 2001. Actually, it was 1 year to the day that we started filming this movie. But I was working on a book with no ending, basically. And when this case was solved, I went to my partners, my friends at Collective Development, DJ Perry, Jeff Kennedy, and I said, you know, guys, we have to adapt what I've got done on this book thus far into a screenplay. We have to tell this story. So for the next 7 months, I worked on a screenplay, knowing full well that we were in pre-production to bring this to the screen.
I think that audiences can expect to see everything that they typically see in your normal Hollywood picture, only the thing is that we have to do it with a much lower sum of money. Everything here is the most energetic project that we've ever had due to the fact of the number of locations, the fact that it's a period piece that uses a certain type of clothing and cars, and you know, it by far the most ambitious thing that we've done yet.
Certainly the movie is unique because it is being told at several of the original locations. Also, what makes this film unique is that the people who have been brought on board, from gaffers, grips, my DP, Stephen Lyons, the producers, the costumers, wardrobers, production designer, everyone is coming on to do this independent film because they believe in telling the story.
Kendall's character has taken an interest in the why these people do what they do. I think he's one of the first people, or he's portrayed in the movie as one of the first people who want to ask those kind of questions, because if they can get into the killer's head and find out why they think the way they do, maybe they can retrace steps and bring these guys to justice.
I mean, he never even viewed her as a person or a human being. He objectifies
the guy who believes in doing them one by one, following up, following up.
Don't tell me what you know. It's not what you know, it's what you can prove. And we can't prove anything against Quincy Hall.
When we recreated the scene of finding the little girl's body, it was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and there was a crisp chill in the air. And I was looking at all these tall standing trees with no leaves on them, just totally naked.
Why don't we just process the scene and see where it takes us?
Well, it's going to have to be processed in Saginaw, or in Saginaw County.
Well, Davey can observe for our team.
He doesn't say a lot. When he says something, he's right on board. He's direct, succinct, to the point. Later on, he opens up. The big city detectives come in, and they open his awareness.
What he would have to do is toss it from his car, from that bridge, and even if he had an arm like Al Kaline, it's not going to end up where the wallet was. And I think that he threw it from that bridge downstream.
They find it usually more interesting to play against the stereotype of the detective that we all see on TV. So maybe it's got to be a little more relaxed, more of a sense of humor.
Can you bring in this, it's a Rolf 22 revolver. Can you bring it in and let us take a look at it, please?
It is a Lansing, East Lansing area detective who is called in on this case to help out with the DNA.
He's out cruising a country road outside of Ann Arbor. He comes across a college couple parking. The girl's blind, for Christ's sakes.
Well, certainly I can't speak for this young woman, but knowing her as I did, how truly sweet she was, loving mother, I think that she would say, if this helps one family, I think she would say, God bless you.
I had a few fears about the role when I was going into it. Actually, my biggest fear was being able to pull off a role of somebody who was a mother and a wife, because that's something that was very new to me, something that I've never done. And then the entire rape and murder scene, I think that moment would be new to anyone, and so it was easy to put myself in that situation and really get involved in it, but I had no idea what that included.
My main thing was to honor not only the memory of Don Swan, who is the story is based on, but the character of Dee McGuire, and also the memory of Ronald Smith, who is also based on a true character who's no longer with us. And I got to do that. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. I you want to say thank you to get to do a part like this, because you don't always get to do something this good.
Not just the little girl, but how it's affected so many people for so long, and it changed this whole community. It was like, in a small way, it's like what Bin Laden did to America. I mean, what this guy did to this little girl. And for him to walk around just as free as a bird for so many years, that was something that really kind of like got me like this. It was like, this just isn't right.
This is all overlooking God. This is based on the ripped open innards of a real family and a real, you know, this is real murder, people really being killed. And I'm sorry for that. I'm as sorry as I could be sitting here for that.
This project really has the real heart and soul of the story, because we are actually immersing our actors and our crew in the same conditions that the story actually unfolded in 1973.
To tell you the truth, I had no real idea the impact of this story, and I knew that it was a true story, but I didn't know that we were in town shooting the true story, in town where I would be meeting people and talking with people that were there on the search when we did the courtyard scene where I'm explaining and rallying people to support and go out and look for the young lady. I was talking with people that were there. And so it's been a tremendous experience. The town is wide open. There's great love in their hearts. And they've welcomed us, the outsiders, people from other communities. And it's just been a great experience, one of the greatest experiences of my life, my professional career.
Thank God. Thank God that all your work pays off, that you're allowed to do something of merit, allowed to work with people who are wonderful, are top of their game. It's always great. Everybody on the set has been completely professional towards me, and that's what I really appreciate.
I've never been so comfortable on location as here, and I love it here. I don't like the weather. I'm not even especially fond of the way people talk here, but I love it here. You know? And that's the experience has been very good here. Because there's a lot of pride here in the fact that it is from here.
I like the spirit that everybody has of the work coming first and getting it done. And when everybody is sort of in the same boat, I find it's usually you can get everybody to give their best. And a story like this will give hope. It'll give hope to people all over the place who maybe it's been 10 years have passed, 15 years have passed, that they can hang on, that if there are people like Lynn Kendall and Dave Sheridan and Ben Bannister and, that this crime might yet be solvable, that someone may bring justice to their loved one. So the story is justified.
Thanks for asking me to be a part of it. And from the bottom of my heart, I hope that everybody enjoys the film. And people that aren't in the film business, it does take a lot of work to make a little movie happen, and when you're sitting there enjoying it, you got to remember that it's cold out there and there's guys freezing and people getting up at 5 a.m. and rolling cable up and everything. So there's a lot that goes into making something happen. So enjoy it, love it, and everybody put a lot of hard work into this. So from the Haggerty family, thank you.
The world premiere event was a huge success with 2 sold-out showings and the stars in attendance. During the 5-day special engagement run at the NCG Multiplex, nearly 3,400 people flooded the theater. We sold out 12 of the 13 screenings. For example, The Matrix Revolutions, during its opening week, same number of days, same screens, only sold 1,029 tickets. We feel that this movie has an emotional impact that is second to none because it is based in truth. And for many communities worldwide who have also suffered similar tragedies, a unique bond of understanding will be found. Their shared loss of innocence that the days of locked doors and trusting strangers is no more. The world is no longer safe, and those that prey on others do exist, but so exists justice and the dedication of those willing to seek it and enforce it. This movie will give hope. Hope that right will still prevail against wrong, that good will overcome evil, and that darkness must one day face the light.
I was impressed. I think the movie's compelling.
I thought that was very interesting to see the history of what was happening. Very well done movie.
I liked it a lot.
Oh, I thought it was just wonderful. You know, very entertaining, very insightful, very good story. It's nice to see justice done after all those years.
That's LeBaron and Sheridan. Now they're working on production. I hope they all please will find out about this jurisdiction change.
When we should get 19?
Good.
button. We have time tonight. We want to get handheld coverage on keys coming up into the seat, the groceries in there, the cigarettes. We want to get some interior close-ups.
We are shooting in Hillcrest Cemetery, Dee's Funeral. We have done the exteriors. We're not shooting actually in here, in the mausoleum. We are shooting inside the hearse, in the exteriors as they're pulling the coffin out. And then a little later, we are shooting at her grave site, which has already been set up.
Sunday morning, they're called out. He just got his overcoat on, khakis, garb.
Our journey to bring this story of hope and justice to the big screen brought us face to face with some of the real victims of this tragic story, including the man at the heart of it, Gerald Wingard.
Your Honor, I've heard the evidence in this case, and the evidence was
there were so many what ifs, and there was really no connection between my client and the murder weapon, our murder weapon to my client, and whether this really was the murder weapon. Mm-hmm. The police officials believe it was, but again, to this day, they are not completely sure whether it was a murder weapon. And we've always maintained this was a relationship, considered to be a sexual relationship. My client exercised his right not to testify, so can't take that any further, but there were just too many what-ifs and possibilities that we think we brought out at, and did successfully at on our closing argument, tying that all together, or really showing that the prosecutor failed to tie it all together. The jury thought otherwise.
Like myself, the judge didn't have any doubt about this defendant's guilt or about the fact that he's a dangerous, dangerous person, even in this day. In cases like this, there is always an appeal. There's always an appeal. So there'll be an appeal. Justice in cases like this would might be something different than life in prison at this stage in his life. He has been, at least at this point, brought to justice, and he's going to know what it's like to not be able to look forward to a free day as long as he lives.
Thank you.
It's been said that hell is the impossibility of reason.
Jesus.
You familiar with Shakespeare? This is a deed without a name.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I am so sorry for your loss. We will catch a man responsible for this. You have my word.
It's not what you know, it's what you can prove. And we can't prove anything against Quincy Hall.
But if your daughter-in-law doesn't show up tomorrow, I'm gonna need to see some bank statements and some insurance policies.
Fine, little prick. You caught up with her, all right? And then you waited for her outside of Bannon's. Then you grabbed her, dragged her into the country, you raped her and you killed her.
Tell me something, Lieutenant. This is one woman. She was murdered 25 years ago. Most of her family's dead. Community's forgotten about it. What's your motivation?
He's still out there.
I just want what any man wants.
Hi, my name is Dennis Turian. I composed the music and did the sound design for Ordinary Killer. We had fun capturing the mood of this small rural community in Michigan. It was a mixture of actually sort of country, you know, Michigan being the soul and Motown state. A mixture of all of those feelings together to just give a feeling of what it's really like to live in Michigan. We try to create a real cohesiveness in the movie by creating themes and then doing variations on those themes throughout the movie to tie everything together from beginning to end. Some of the music was written in the studio while the director was there, which makes it a lot of fun for the composer because it's all about improvising and creating different vibes and templates of sound.
Yeah. Nice short shopping trip, D.
And it's always a challenge to work with a director to try to get that sound that he's looking for.
You will be given specific areas of the county to search, and you will be backed up by sheriff's mounted posse, canine units, a helicopter crew, and boats are going to float the Shaw attack. God bless y'all for helping us out.
We really got to take the music to a lot of different places, from writing music to fit on car radios in a scene to, the murder scene.
It was a little longer ago than I thought when I got
scenes experience. Of epiphany.
I didn't kill nobody!
It was a lot of fun to work with the drama in this movie.
You know, 6 weeks ago, the search team got that close?
I mean, look. The entry wounds. He shot her in the back. Which tells me that the act of killing isn't what drives him.
Well, if he could have put his hands on another car, it'd be pretty easy to stash the baby in the back.
So all the music that you're hearing is actually music that was composed for the movie. Not necessarily to the scenes that you're seeing. We just wanted to give you a feel for all the different directions that we went in.
Hi, I'm Tony Harness, writer-director of An Ordinary Killer. We're going to take you on a 30-year journey through the Argus Press archives. Took a page out of Oliver Stone's filmmaking, and we started the film with a Bible passage that we thought was appropriate. We didn't know what we had in the early going, that a woman was missing, and that was about it. Here's the photo as it appeared in the Argus Press back in 1973, the big search scene. And what you're going to see next is how we depicted it in the film.
This young girl, Dee, became synonymous with the community's loss of innocence. If one of their own could disappear without a trace, then nobody was safe anymore.
Good morning. I'm Detective Sergeant David Sheridan of the Ottawa County Sheriff's Department, and I'm in charge of this operation today. On behalf of Ottawa County law enforcement, and the friends and family of D. Smith McGuire, I would like to thank each and every one of you for being here today. Now, we're going to split you all up into four different groups, and each group is going to be assigned leaders. Police officers will lead you. You will be given specific areas of the county to search, and you will be backed up by sheriff's mounted posse, canine units, a helicopter crew, and boats are going to float the Shaw Tack. God bless you all for helping us out.
Searchers got within about a quarter of a mile of Don's body, little did they know. But 36 days after the abduction, the mystery would be solved, and it's what everyone feared.
Come on, man. He just waltzed her in the woods here, and he executed her. What are you talking about?
You on the radio, sir?
What? No, killing her was incidental.
All right, just a second. After you scrape the nails, dust those rings. Now listen, don't miss anything. You hear me?
I'm about to pee.
Yeah.
We've got nothing from the two track, and there's no sign of a struggle here. I mean, but how many times has it snowed and thawed since then?
He dreams. The act of killing her was merely to protect the future fulfillment of a fantasy. I mean, he never even viewed her as a person or a human being. He objectifies.
Wait a minute. I mean, now you got me confused.
What I'm trying to say is that he never really had the stomach for a more intimate killing, say like strangulation or even stabbing. I mean, look, the entry wounds. He shot her in the back, which tells me that the act of killing isn't what drives him. I mean, he'd done his deed, and he didn't want to waste any more time. So he just made sure that she was dead and did him off so he didn't get caught.
Now I'm really lost.
State police, with Detective Bart Barnes leading the way, checked literally hundreds of leads. They went through dozens of suspects. I actually saw the suspect list when we went back to work on this story in 1994, and I actually knew some of the people on that list. There were 12 suspects that they really liked. They couldn't clear. And authorities, lacking the clues, like most other cases like this, it grew cold. It was a real-life CSI.
For a time after Ben and I parted on that day 5 years ago, we'd talk on the phone about the McGuire case. But those calls became less and less frequent. We all had other cases to focus on, and I hadn't talked to him for nearly 3 years when he called it a career. They say that Ronald Smith, for all practical purposes, died on that cold winter night, along with his daughter. Sheridan told me that he checked with him once a week until his death, asking about any progress that we'd made on catching his little girl's killer. For Ben, I know that the McGuire case is the one that all cops dread, the one that they could not close.
The case was cold for 20 years. Then it was hard detective work, new technology, and yeah, a little luck that led to an arrest.
Mark, where are you?
In Ottawa, waiting for my daughter to get out of her dance thing.
You gotta get over to the lab right now. I'm with Glenn. Mark, the preliminary DNA analysis on Watson's saliva is done.
It's him, isn't it?
13 out of 13 genetic markers. Here's Glenn.
There's 6 billion people in the world. We'd have to look at 16 quadrillion in order to get a similar profile to the characteristics that we get.
Detective Mark Pendergraft of the Michigan State Police, who I'd been working with quite a bit for 6-7 years on this case. We just bounced information off each other. But he called me the night before they were going down to arrest Gerald Wingart, and he actually told me when they were interviewing him in the room at his plant in Sterling Heights that they did actually pull out a picture of Don Magyar. And it really flustered him. Of course, we were on top of it, the Argus Press, getting the tip from Mark, and we were on hand when they brought him into the state police post in Owosso the next morning, and it was an amazing photo by Kathy Schneider of the Argus Press. And you can see from these clips, there were a lot of happy people, family members, detectives, and come to find out, Gerald Wingert had been charged in a murder in Ionia, which is also depicted in the film, and they police believe he is a serial killer.
Ligature strangulation, Iosco County, 79. Girls found dead with a rope around her neck. They can't trace it because it's ordinary hardware rope. Mm-hmm. They know rape is the motivation. They can't get a semen sample because they don't find the body for 7 months and it's already decomposed.
What the hell are you talking about?
I just got off the phone with the sheriff, you know, when I sent out that lean message asking about Watson. Mm-hmm. He called me up and he said Watson had abducted a 16-year-old jogger from the side of a rural road, a local saw him. He thought it looked odd. I guess he was driving a Suburban, and he had a dog hanging out the back, and they strike up a conversation. Now this local is smart enough to write down the license plate number, which is pretty amazing, okay? The girl turns up missing.
The long legal process was about to begin, and I believe it took a little less than a year. Gerald Wingert, arrogant until the end, very, very scary guy. Here he's at the counsel table with an assistant. Trial was held in Howell. A lot of riveting moments in the trial. The blind lady testifying, and Mr. Wingert was found guilty. I really don't think he believed he was going to be found guilty, and as you can tell by this expression here. And in the end, it was the family, police, prosecutors, and the jury who spoke for Don Magyar, dead for 30 years. Bart Barnes could retire officially. Good investigator. Don Magyar interviewed Don a year before this was published. He, like everyone else, relieved with some sense of closure.
We worked hard so that you could be heard, sweetheart. I'm only sorry that your father and Ben didn't get to see justice served.
Justice. A concept we cling to. Yes. One day he will face justice. And as for this life, he'll never hurt anyone again. We're grateful for everything you did, all of you. But there is no justice. No closure in a loss like this. Only grief. And it's permanent. If you boys have children, go home and give them a hug.
Sadly, I've met many parents like the Smiths since 1973. I've spent my entire career trying to understand the emotional disturbance embodied in the Gary Watsons of this world. What scares me the most? I'm not even close.